And actually, I think it assumes that all we're interested in is the maximal number of right actions, and we just do the fact that the action was done has to be its own end. Then you have what is usually called the utilitarian ethic, but more broadly a consequentialist ethic. But you have to distinguish between two types of consequentialist ethics, or more commonly distinguish what they call a virtue and utilitarian ethics. The standard consequentialist ethic is we look at what happens at the overall consequences in the world of what you've done. And if you take a particular utilitarian perspective, we might narrow it down to does it create more pleasure or more pleasure in the world than any other alternative, more pleasure or more of a greater amount of pleasure than pain. Although you have to qualify that, that Bentham said very crudely pleasure and pain. You want to maximize the Hanoi quotient of your actions. Mill argued that you have to distinguish between higher and lower pleasures, and once you distinguish higher and lower pleasures, the whole concept breaks down in a useful way, but it's fun to talk about. You can't distinguish one person's higher pleasure than a person's lower pleasure, where is the basis for judgment, all sorts of issues like that. So another way of looking at halacha is to say that halacha is ultimately a consequentialist system in that relevance, like halacha, at least that halacha there is supposed to create a society in which the most good happens, however one defines the good. We make an a priori determination that society is better organized if there are rules, and people generally obey the rules than not. But there are always occasions where the rules are counterproductive, and you have to decide whether the effect of breaking the rule has long-term consequences that are worse than the effect of keeping the rule in the specific instance. Okay, like any judge has to decide that. There are always going to be cases where the law leads to ridiculous conclusions. But on the other hand, if you just start making it up, then you lose law. No, I'm pointing out consequentialist ethics. Virtue ethics cares about consequences also, but only cares about the internal consequences. And generally, it only cares about the internal consequences for the person doing the action. You can set up a combination in which the way you judge your action is does it maximize virtue in the world, as opposed to does it maximize virtue in the actor. But usually virtue ethicists care about say that you judge the action by its effect on your soul, as opposed to the consequentialists who say you take an account as being outside. For most visions of friends, there are an easy case for these clash is I think that what God put me on earth for is to be an artist. In order for me to be an artist or a doctor, somebody else has to sacrifice their life to be likely to be deeply unhappy. But I understand that for me to be the best person I can be, is to develop my artistic talent, to develop my medical ability, not because I think I'll heal people.
You're developing your vision of virtue from the
Buddha? How am I doing that? No, through deep self-knowledge. Yes, sir.
Your concept of virtue ethics is different from your concept of ethics.
Act ethics, it doesn't matter what the effect on you. It might turn out, if you were, in a halakhic perspective, right? I know that every time I shake a loaf, love always remind me of this desperate urge I have to spear chihuahuas on the ends of sharp objects. So every time I shake a look, I become less and less sensitive to star balls I am, because it's just, that's what I do. I shake a look and I fantasize about spearing chihuahuas. it's terrific. Every time. It reinforces my notion that the law exists in the sexist, racist, misogynist, whatever you want to call it, right? All those things can happen. And you probably say, right, you kind of say, well, okay, so let's take our nice, non-controversial example. Should I keep shaking my wool even though it makes me insensitive to the terrible kind? Yes. Yeah. So it's an instant, shake a wool. Right, so you're shaking a wool even though every time you scream, even though you know that
every time you should write that if you take a look, you're encouraging the planting of palm trees somewhere with somewhere or otherwise there would be subsistence farmers growing it, right, growing ecologically sound practices instead of industrial palm trees with pesticides taking up land that's no useful purpose. So there's a little pesticide warning there, because we're in the center of the rain.
I think it would be a better example for that, right?
So what? In an act, I think it doesn't matter, right? The purpose is, hey, I'm doing the hockey system. Right? And the county notion comes from a different understanding for us. And the hockey system, that's what it means. Just the mix of itself is the goal. We end up, when we get to Rosh Hashanah, what we want to make sure is that we have one more mitzvah on there so the world goes through, so the world goes on. But we're not thinking about that. We're just trying to do it. If we're just trying to do it, that would be a consequential story, we're saying. Right? We're doing this because it keeps the world going. Otherwise, the planet might survive, but God would just destroy the world anyway. We're under count. Yes.
And I think you can still articulate why you value the
Muslim.
It's just you don't
know
about it
as a Muslim. That's right. Okay. You can articulate why, but we have a clash.
It's not a conversation stopper. It's not, we just value
the Muslim. You have to come with a peculiar position. I mean, then we get into rough issues. You can talk about why you value the Muslim. The rough argument, you can't do that. You can talk about what value you derive from the Muslim, which is not the same as why you value the Muslim. You value them because God said so.
Okay, you can articulate why a lot about it.
Once you articulate why, then you're going to get any other questions that happen to me then. So, right? That's why Rob talks about that rationale.
You can't ask why that. That doesn't mean that
you're looking for it. No, but if you start coming up with answers, then...
Right, you ask why God said so, then what happens if doing it, right, if doing it conflicts with why God said so?
Then you were wrong.
So then you get it from a logical standpoint as opposed to... Right. But I think you have trouble in a pure activist articulating why...
You can use reasons for it, just you can't say, and I adopted them, and therefore, more of it will be better.
More of the reason would be. Okay, and I'm not sure that we're arguing. So, yeah. Hang out later. Right, so the virtuous ethic is all about self-development. And I give the artist example, but I think that there are, right, so there are situations where you can talk about what's best for me is to do X, but what's best for society is Y, and that comes up very often in terms of Sartre's new birth. Right, you can say honestly, you know what, this is the, in the long term, the community, communal good will be accomplished by not doing X, Y, and Z, but it leaves me no time to learn. And so I will feel, 40 years later, like the community is in good shape, but I never accomplished what I should have accomplished in life. I feel incomplete. Yes?
Isn't the kind of submission to the good of the community considered also an individual virtue?
Maybe, but I know myself. At the end of my life, if I spent 40 years running around taking care of all the communal needs that we're going to be able to take care of, I'll just end up bitter and unhappy. The communities will still get done because I have a sense of beauty that's powerful enough to keep me going. This is not so hypothetical. but it might be an argument. I once asked the dean of the initiative college whether it was a success, what the issue was with respect to the professor getting tenure. He said, well, the question is, the great teaching and important service to community, we're failing to add another file of unreadable mediocre scholarships to the already giant, very giant pool. And from a material standpoint, there's no question. Yeah, but on the other hand, it might be that somebody will see this and say, I know I'm good on committees, and I'm a good teacher, but what I think, what makes me feel most complete is writing mediocre scholarships on L3. That's what he does, So I can certainly say somebody could make the argument to me that, you really feel like that to achieve your complete sense of what you need to be evidence and what you need to do is, what you need to do is to write a thesis. So I'm looking at it from the outside, I'm saying, you're going to write a thesis and you'll print 10 copies and maybe your relatives will buy it and then they'll put it under the coffee urn to hold it up. That's what you're asking to your, to do a paper. So we really need your thesis. You're just writing for yourself. It's selfish. You're selfish.
And those are different, right? Those are different models. So I'm saying, right, and there are, not infrequently, I think, there are times where one's public duty and one's private quest for spiritual growth come in conflict. Whether you can say in some ultimate sense, if you could say, if you were really a sophisticated person, you could say, well, since this is all, right, since the right thing to do in the objective and consequential sense must be what God wants, therefore, if I understood that properly, it would cause me, but it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, it's the, there's all sorts of things that are corrosive to the soul, even though they're even publicly necessary. Being a politician. Fundraising. There are all sorts of things that you could do, you know, that you might, to many people, you can legitimately feel that, you know, that you feel little pieces of your soul flaking off and you have somebody else to do them. So in terms of Lashon Hara, so I think it's really important to distinguish, right, almost, right, to distinguish whether the attractiveness or unattractiveness of a particular vision is rooted in a virtue perspective, right, even at a social level. So I think people will be better people that way or not, or in a consequential perspective, it means that I think this is good for society. And part of that goes back to the situation, the question of whether we only encourage virtues that are universalizable. We only encourage people to develop virtues if we would want everyone else to be like them. Because it's perfectly conceivable to argue that the best type of person is a person who never says anything bad about anybody else. And each person, if you ask me, what kind would you be a better person if you cultivated the need of being Dhammakat Khut and of never saying anything negative to anybody else, would you be a better person? Yeah, you would be an impressive person. But if everyone were like you, then society would just be run by Khutmas. So it's very important that there be people who are willing to say bad things about people, because otherwise society is awful. But it may be that you can, right, that we have room. But that's the nature of society, means that it's not possible to have, I guess it looks, we can do it, today's supposed to be a fellow entertainer day, so we'll do a very fancy director version of this. So the, Noah gets drunk after the flood. And he becomes naked in his tent, and Ham comes along and sees his nakedness, and Noah curses Ham. Why does Noah get drunk? And what's so terrible about Ham? So here's one perspective. I'm going to cut a much longer version short. Noah gets drunk because the Medrash picks up. Noah sees himself as a new Adam HaRishon. And as a new Adam HaRishon, if he wants to do is to go back to Gan Eden, the thing you have to do to go back to Gan Eden is to forget about the difference between Tov and Ra. The way you forget about the difference between Tov and Ra is you get drunk. Right? That's what you do on purpose. Right? Adam and Ahmed Ar-Rahman was the Lord of Mordecai. So what Noah's trying to do, he's trying to go back to Gan Eden. Okay, much longer version of this word tells you that the other way back to Gan Eden is Karbanos, and that's why Noah's being Karbanos, but it's why there are, you know, you can look up what is the purpose of animal sacrifice on the web, but there are two fun giveaways to this. One is that there are two places where there are Kruzim and Chumash, starting the way back to Gan Eden and in the center of the Kodesh Kodeshim, and the other is Halakha Smara, which tells you that when it comes to Kabbalah, you can't distinguish between Tov and Ra, which otherwise makes very little sense, but if you think about it in that framework, I think it makes a lot of sense. That one actually came up with both. Right? We were talking together while we were still engaged, I think. I'm pretty sure I came up with it because you did verse
service.
I would not wish to give the evaluation of the verse. I think that I came up with it, boy, because you said you did verse service, that you did verse service for the next thing. Noah ends up not going back to Gan Eden, he ends up just being a naked man all around in the tent. there are a bunch of different ways of reading this. I find it as like the, you can say that what the Chula teaches you is that Gaiden isn't such a good place to be because Gaiden is just naked people rolling around the tent. That's what we call the postmodern reading of the story, the reflection of the two stories. Or you can claim that, that you can't undo experience. Like, innocence is not regainable. Right? That Adam and Chava were innocent, whereas Noah is avoiding, and Noah is denying it, right? And you can't undo the past. You already had the earth overall, you can't lose it. And so as you had it, and denying it is not regaining innocence, but abdicating responsibility. So there's a thought more provocative thing, which is that Noah would have succeeded, because you can regain innocence, you just can't maintain innocence in the presence of experience. You can't be the one person who is innocent, because as soon as Ham walks in, then Noah regains experience because he understands how Ham is looking at him. And he all of a sudden, instead of being in this framework of not being Tovarah, all of a sudden once again Noah is an antidote to Tovarah, and the whole experience is lost because Ham punctures the capacity to maintain it. Innocence can't be sustained in light of experience. So that's true, I think, in that case. I think that innocence very rarely survives experience. Innocence in the face of experience requires one to avoid so much of reality that it almost always becomes pathological. And this is based on experience of the summer bonding of our tzaddikim. And precisely because they are tzaddikim, they are profoundly dangerous human beings. And it's true in this case of Lashon Hara, but I can say that there were rabbis in the Leiner case. There were rabbis in the Leiner case who acted out of work sense of priority, simple malice. But there were also rabbis who acted the way they did because they were tzaddikim, and they were not demanding down the kafu. And they really thought of the Bush and Harav, and they were talking about this. And they were, this mommy said you came, and they were saying you came from Nahr. So, I tend to think that you can't be a tzaddik, and tzaddikim can't be communal leaders in that sense. People who are focused entirely on their own virtue are profoundly dangerous when they engage in traditional communal leadership, and therefore one has to understand that agreement to be a communal leader is often not just because you lose your time to learn, but often it involves a surrender of aspiration to success. Certain kinds of success. But that doesn't mean that there aren't areas of success that you can cultivate that aren't relevant to your leadership. It doesn't mean everyone has to be a leader. And it might be, for example, if you ask me, again, so what's the best kind of person to be, right? So I think that people who really internalize Chavos Chaim often, at least the Chumrah is not the clue, can become tremendous study students. But, God help you if you accept the shit of something. God help you if they ever are in a position where they have responsibility to supervise anybody else. I think it's an extraordinarily rare person who can somehow maintain their character entirely while taking that responsibility. So part of what I'm excited about, is that trying to get people to understand that there are some virtues, that are only universalizable in moderation. So the Chavos Chaim virtues, I think it's a really, I think that what the Chavos Chaim sets out is a great way of training yourself to virtues. There are situations where it's deeply irresponsible. So you can take a very narrow sense of what you read. So for example, if you make a decision only to read about corruption in your town, then you have absolutely no way of contextualizing your town. Right, you can't make judgments at all. you end up, if you only accept information which you have direct knowledge, right, and you don't repeat it to anybody, and then everybody lives in isolation, and everybody thinks, oh, this is the only time it ever happened, right? I was the only victim, right? There are no friends. We know that well-regarded people never lie in public, right? The one case was that, right? All sorts of things like that. So part of it's going to start to me, part of the retention between last night's presentation and what I try to teach you is that this is always, you know, this is a program that pretty explicitly aims at leadership development, and you can't teach leaders to aspire to face it, because those are not compatible goals. I'm trying to write this up as a blog post now for new blogs that are voting is organizing. That's why I teach the direct Jonathan for. But I think that at the same time, that it's valuable to understand what the virtue goal is, and then the real challenge is to figure out how you, as opposed to, I would argue, adopting a conceptually coherent position as to whether ethics are grounded in act, virtue, or consequences, you recognize that each of them has a value. This is where Baruch Brody is really. Baruch Brody is called the theory of pluralist ethics, which is not a Jewish denominational pluralism, but an epistemological pluralism, in which he argues that, you know what, in almost every complicated ethical choice, particularly in medical ethics, you discover that each perspective is valid based on different legitimate assumptions, and particularly whether the assumption, right, what you're grounding in terms of what the principle of ethics you're acting on is, and then what halacha does. Right? I think it's a really interesting theory of halacha. What halacha does is try and find the proper balance between these equally legitimate values, and not just, I'm trying to value human life as opposed to I'm trying to value Shabbos. So I'm trying to value the broad principle, I'm trying to value the development of human beings as opposed to the good of society, I'm trying to value virtue as opposed to pleasure. And all of those, we don't want to end up with situations where we say, well, it's really good for 6 million peasants to die, because that way we have a society which is genuinely communist. Right? That was a pure virtue argument, in a sense. Like, it was a consequential argument. From now on, everyone will be fair. Okay, I'll leave it up.
Are you prepared to say that based on those comments that Moshe Rabbeinu was a great leader but not a prophet?
So, eight topics, right, that sounds like there's an objective bar.
I mean, you were talking about the incommensurate goals of saintliness.
So I use tzaddik, to be careful, I'm going to give you a technical sense or not. Do I mean, let's say, in the sense of whether should the Jewish observer put a tzaddik in the Jewish writing along in the obituary? Yes, the Jewish observer should have put a tzaddik. But if they were writing an obituary for Moshe Rabbeinu, they should say that's valid, not valid. Do I know that Moshe Rabbeinu became the best person he could be in that sense? That first of all is a complicated question to ask. Right? But for me, right, for me to ask that question, right, like pondering the question of the Moshe Rabbeinu became everything he could be. What you could say is that on the one hand, Moshe Rabbeinu got angry, very frustrated, experienced all sorts of emotions as a Kabbalah leader, that probably if he'd been allowed to meditate for life, he was out of experience. On the other hand, and the same thing we said before, that when there are situations where you are the only person who can do something well, then it's a very rare person who can be conscious that they could have made a really important contribution to other people and are choosing their own self-development over that. For whom that realization isn't itself corrupting. It doesn't require you continually to justify yourself being more important than everybody else in the world and leading to some kind of massive egoism. Right? I don't know that once you're confronted by the choice, right, when God comes to you and says, I want you to take my people out of Egypt, you say, well, you know what? I understand taking people out of Egypt is important. But so is, protecting my character if I never get angry. If I become leader of those people, I know myself, I'm going to get angry at these people. So thank you very much. I can't take the people out of Egypt because I'm working on a visa cost right now. But on the other hand, if your goal is to get rid of your visa cost, then it's a sacrifice you need. Right. You already tried, that may be one understanding of why of what he's trying to get at it.
But what I'm
trying to say is
that you can be making a sense on that, that you
really have
to
deal with
the right
decision.
And
in
that sense, that
sort of
undermines
the sort of
ethical theory.
I think
what
you're saying is you need to become a leader with the right decision.
That's
yeah, I tend to think.
That's right, and I think that you're undermining the
sort of
the thing. Why? You're
not saying that, because there may be cases where, because if it's the case, the only difference Muncher made in his knee is they would have left his trying 5 seconds earlier. And instead of becoming this incredible, an incredible person with defensive responsibility, who just sometimes becomes angry. And, again, as well, it's a question that requires a reverence answer. But when he would have gotten out of his trying 5 seconds earlier, and the consequence was that at the end of his life, he would have started throwing, chucking spears at people randomly because he thought they were threatening his throne, right? Which, to some degree, is an issue Shaul will face. Right? So if you ask me, if the only difference Moshe Rabbeinu has made is 5 seconds, and the consequence of his turning into Shaul, I don't know what the right choice is. You have to know, right? You have to know what the consequences are. There are people who understand, who properly make the decision that their susceptibility to the corruptions of power are so great that, that even if the consequences are good, it's just not, the money.
Yeah, but
no, I'm saying, you know what? The consequences of the community will be better even if I end up being hopelessly corrupt. But I'm not willing to do that. I'm not willing to do it, right? So it does to me, right? Yeah, I have friends who make those choices, usually the wrong way. Because most people, dramatically overestimate the impact they will have in the world. And as leaders, can underestimate the effect it has on their character. Right? Some people get it the other way around. So there aren't answers.
And I really don't mean this in a political way. That's probably common of your orthodox perspective.
What, they overestimate their impact?
No, that they're so, obsessively committed to, doing the act of keeping the mitzvah. So, the idea of maintaining their character is,
No, it's only a question of mitzvah. I'm not talking about the fact of mitzvah. I'm talking about communal good versus individual development. I'm just playing on that axis. The Orthodox has nothing to say one way or the other.
I'm not talking about the
Orthodox people are much more trained to think about the act of emphasis in the ritual.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm not addressing that question. I'm just saying, and it's a very, it's a very hard thing. I have had friends who I asked, to write down things they would never do before taking certain positions. So they would have a check. It's important to take that position, but write down the things you'd never do. And of course they do them. Rapidly. Because being in certain positions, put you in positions to resign, where you have to resign very early if you want to maintain your principles, and you feel the weight, so you don't resign.
Also, the things that come to mind first when you're making that list are probably the things you're most likely to do.
Yeah. Of course, and it's hard. That's a very, very, very simple.
If you're aware of the fact that this is an issue that's going to come up in this sort of position, it means that you probably have some sort of a question.
Because usually it's very quite on. It's a very easy case, right? You know that in your institution, there is a dominant, powerful figure who is evil. It's just a simple thing, right? Let's say you wrote a secret report which reveals that no one else knows the evidence that demonstrates that one of your faculty members in fact is evil. And then somebody else in the position of president of that institution. Right? But part of the deal is in order to become president of that institution is that you're not ready that you can ever act on the basis of that report. So you have to act as if that person is deeply respected and right. That's an easy example. In most positions, when you take a communal position, you're going to end up having to say nice things about colleagues, even if you know those colleagues are evil. So you're not going to remain a faculty member of the yeshiva today. if you say that one of the problems is people, and right, so if you take the job, right, I mean, that you really think that the thoughts are going to start from that person, then right, then it means you're going to have to stand by and watch, right, and watch students be assigned to that person's class, all sorts of things that you have to make. In every organization, there's a choice that you have to make. And you don't know for sure. It might be that the institution will tolerate you cutting your colleague dead in public if he walks over to you with a big smile on his face and says, "Shalom aleichem, welcome to the club." It might be that if you look at him and say, "I think you're invisible," that the institution will tolerate you. Hey, it's not so likely. It's a big chance. Not so likely. So I think those are part of the choice that I made is lack of effectiveness in some ways because I was joining organizations and sort of trying to buy back that was the longer about that. I think it's exactly what sort of was said because you have to be aware of the both consequences and you have to figure out. You have to figure out how much difference you can make and whether some people's character is not harmed by power. But most people do. And also, this is a pure most of this is private message, but usually it's that what ends up happening to most people in their careers is that you make small compromises to get, because you think that if I don't make this compromise now, then I'm never going to get anywhere to have any influence. But what happens is, the next time a question comes along, you not only have to justify doing this thing wrong, but if you do the right thing now, and you end up, let's say, in my first year as a Rebbe, somebody asked, a rich donor, the principal comes to me and says that one of your kids, who you're planning to give a bidu, is a child of a rich donor, and the rich donor is going to pull the funding if the school doesn't get the kid to Harvard, you better give the kid an A-. And you figure, you know what? Wow, look at this corrupt society where money determines grades. Right? And look, there's a principle in supporting this kind of perjury. If I ever get these principles, I'm never going to allow that. But if I say no now, I get fired, I'm going to have a bad reference, I'm going to be out of touch. Mm-hmm. So it's really important, right? So I'm going to do this right now for the sake of growing up to be the kind of person, so that in 10 years, I can be principal, and I can tell people not to do that. Okay. Then a year later, the principal comes to you and has the same question, except this time the point is that there were two kids who handed the same paper, and the question is, which one are you giving up for plagiarism? And the truth is, you don't know, or even you do know, that it's the rich kid who copied off the poor kid, not the poor kid who copied off the rich kid. But the principal said, you know what, in this school, everything runs on the basis of, right, on the basis of what that year says, and so if you don't do it now, and then right, then you're fired, and by the way, you'll get a reference, Now if you say no, that means that you changed the grade last year for no reason. So you didn't get any influence from it. And now that there is unjustified. And each time something gets asked of you, you have to recognize that if you go on this time, then you make all the previous moral sacrifices you made useless. So you end up justifying larger and larger moral sacrifices. So you end up making bigger and bigger compromises, because the only way you can possibly justify the task is if you get all these things in the world. And if I don't get to be principal, then I can't justify all the things I did, all the things I did along the way. Until finally, at some point, you're going to get to the realization that nothing that I do in life is ever going to make up something to do wrong. And at that point, if you're saying you're going to suicide, right, and if you're an ordinary person, you end up justifying all your capacity. Things they were really right, that was really right. Well, you need to become a member of the system.
Too late in an option?
Sure, the form of suicide in that sense. You're going to be undoing your whole past. Right. You can maybe get the children out of it. And you can find some way in which you can be a person who gives a list of truth to students that prevents them from going down this evil path. Going down this path or something like that. But very, very hard. Very, very hard to a really good way of internalizing this is Ethan Cannon has a short story, I think it's called Emperor of the Air. which is just a terrifying story. If I was doing formal teacher training, I would probably make all the teachers read it, but then I'd probably have to give them a week off. Because it's just so terrifying about what happens, you know, when you make a compromise like that. But it lays it out in beautiful dark detail. But the story is just, you know, sort of left me shaking for a long time.
What is it?
I think it's called Emperor of the Air. I think it's the title. It's a novella. It's the title of a collection of Ethan Cannon short stories. You haven't heard of Ethan Cannon? That'll be nice to read. But that one's fictitious. It's shattering. It's like, you know, where's the Cusker novel about being a teacher? Okay. So that was one framework I wanted to put in place. Let's finish off this Macara set and use it to introduce, I want to do one other methodological click here, and then I'm not going to do anything intense. I want to lay out what we're trying to accomplish and leave it at that. So I gave you I gave them called the Juro. Basically gives you the same thing. You've got the Elias set in a much more word source perspective. Trying to say do this, do that, right? You know, the inspirational. Word source. RTADORY. As in a source. We started framing everything in terms of Nepsi. And that's the only issue of public surprise is what is Nepsi. But really it's always good to publicize people. Then you get the Covaturin. Covaturin, first of all, tells you that, you know, it seems that because it says it's supposed to have different shots in the garden than a song, if that were comfortable with. Then he says, Shalom has a different master, what can I show this for each set? But also, Shalom is saying, Hill, Sule, Yvray, and Sule, will be here coming up, name for the same person as Clam, Rich, Ball, Bet, Yvray, and Lane, Clam. So this is sort of enigmatic. Why does he think Yvray and Sule? There's
that.
Because
he thinks they're giving
any packages to anything you want. Absolutely right. Because, right, because, right, I think the other term just says, how can those who say this, which is the same, there's no one there, it's only three people. Right, there's nothing textual about it then. He understands perfectly well that this is an entirely plausible way of reading the text. Just he looks at it and he says, but it can't be. It can't be. And therefore, and then instead of giving any kind of normal logic response, he says, okay, look at the seven times. And the Chavis Chaim will solve this problem by explaining to us in a way which is morally acceptable. The I think, is valuable that way. So he sort of just gives you a sense, I think, of the way in which the Chavis Chaim took over the world. That after the Chavis Chaim, he will just look at it and say, that's impossible. And when the impossible has been eliminated, what remains, whatever impossible must be true. Yes, sir.
When we were discussing this, okay, I didn't understand. The easy move is a really, really easy textual move to make to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And that's reading the Tosfos Bar Lashon instead of the narrative. You don't have to do it. There's no compelling textual reason you need to do it. If I'm a Kalkon and I'm super bothered by this statement, that's a really straightforward, really easy move to make.
And sometimes that's what the Chavis Chaim is going to do.
Okay, that's what he does? Okay.
Yeah, sometimes that's what the Chavis Chaim is going to do. But to say the word Tzvuin, right, you know, that's a lot, you know, at the end, he just sends you back. I think this is just an illustration of the extent to which the Chavis Chaim just closed the door on conversation. For a little bit real. You know, where he just said it's impossible to imagine what he said. Okay, so what's going to happen in the next set of Makara is I just gave you where the Chavis Chaim is going to throw all the evidence he can at you to convince you that the straightforward reading of Tosfos is impossible. And having convinced you, hopefully, that's impossible, he'll then go on to tell you, right, to tell you what must be true of the alternative. So I have you first do all the evidence, what he does, and then read the Chavis Chaim. And see if you think the evidence he provides is sufficiently compelling that that you're willing to say that it that the reading the reading you would have had if you just read these documents independently is impossible, and so therefore the reading that he offers must be the truth. Okay, so I want the way I set this up pedagogically is first I want you to go through the text on your own so you can figure out what you would think these texts mean on their own. Then you can look at what the first-hand evidence is and say, well, now that I have the text, the fundamental text, in the context of these other texts, does that in fact have an insoluble problem for me? And if it does, then the first-hand will be the most compelling. If it doesn't, it makes me feel inside the first-hand, the bar isn't really so high, the first-hand does the plausible reading, and it's better than the others. And if I only had a chance to evaluate the text on their own, evaluate the evidence on your own, and then, right, and then see if see if his presentation of the text and the evidence is one that you find convincing or plausible or or ridiculous or partially convincing, whatever you want. Okay, that's the intellectual training.
So the last few lines of the post-hearing is basically like we're at a point where we're at, let's say, the second line from the bottom.
Yeah.
We're saying to ourselves, like, this is shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to sort of figure out, in some sense, like, what are we going to write in line in the last line for ourselves?
Well, it is like, is it shocking?
Right.
And then figure out, well, you know, if it's shocking, if you think it is shocking, then is that your solution going to be, okay, well, it's shocking, and he has a way out, so let's just take his way out. And it's basically, you know, kind of basically abdicate any personal responsibility for the figure. So the first time we told us how to gather this impossibility.
So we don't share the consensus that this is shocking?
I don't know. Do you find that it's shocking and it does? Okay, then you're fine. Do you find it's
me. I was just under the assumption that that was true and that maybe I shouldn't be.
Okay, well that should be a useful conversation over something. Over the next several weeks. And even if you find it shocking, there are all the ways out of the way that
I'm saying. But I'm just saying from that,
okay, so that's, I'm interested to know, but not right now. Right, how many of you share that Archimedean point that just reading something was like my 11th grade Rebbe walking out of class with the end of the evening thing in front of three people who's under is utterly impossible or not. Okay, so what I want to do is briefly introduce ways of relating to those kinds of things. So one thing just to be aware of is you have to decide whether Lishna Bisha and Lashon Hara are terms that have only one meaning. Or whether you think if we use a model of genetic Zeva, there are other structure, whether you think that sometimes these are terms that have specific legal meaning, and sometimes these are just generic terms for things you shouldn't say. Because a lot of the evidence may depend on the assumption that the term is used in the same way every time. But if you take the definition of, say, the Sfaradim, right, that you can use Lashon Hara to mean false speech, or you can use Lashon Hara to mean true speech, then you have no problem saying that things that are said about, if this thing is impossible to say that it's a false speech, that doesn't mean it's impossible to say that true speech, and the whole thing goes out the window. Okay. That's right, just right. First decision you have to make is whether you want to share the assumption that, which I think in some places the first time is going to make, that the term Lashon Hara Lishna Bisha always means the same thing. I don't want to lay out what I talked about usually is the four ways of resolving contradictions. The four ways of resolving contradictions, at least rabbinically, are, call them, Girsa, Chakira, Chazda, and Okibka. Girsa, Chakira, Cheshbon, and Okimta. Or Gizmuta, for sure. I'm just trying to go with Girsa, Cheshbon, Chakira, and Okimta. Or if you can reverse the order, you go, nah. It's about the two things on delicacy. What is worms? Try it too bad. The Klingon status, the Degeche. I confess that I have not ever really translated any of the papers that were handed in to me like that. So that does happen regularly. There's a program on the web that translates papers in the Klingon. So every year, one student hands in a paper in Klingon City. Your secondary class, I think. This is actually a kid's mother handed it in. I just heard this spontaneously as a gift. That makes me think in Klingon.
No.
I never even know the translator. There is, they're in the dictionary. I can't even sing the opera, the Battlecruiser or something other, which is the famous Klingon opera. I can't sing it properly.
This might be a way to close this on and make me dry.
Only after 3 weeks, so. Yeah. Although, like, the real number is if you for humans, it would be much more efficient. My father will stand on my violin plate. Alright. I know the answer is a long day. It's gotta be entertaining. So, here it is, we have a contradiction. You just claimed that one of the texts is wrong. Alright, so. These texts, if you're right, it says in text A that 1 plus 1 equals 2. But it says in text D that 1 plus 1 equals 3. No! Right, the text that says 1 plus 1 equals 3 really should say 2. I mean, that's one solution.
Or, this text is 1 plus 1 is 2, this text is 1 plus 1 is 3, so another text is 2 plus 1 is 3.
Yeah, right, here's the, in some ways, a cheap way out, because of course you can solve any problem, right, through Girsa. But you have to be aware of it. Sometimes that in fact is the case, and particularly this thing is important to be aware that, conditions often do depend on what Girsa you have. We saw that the Syrian Rabba, right, that Joseph points out depends on your gifts of the servicing, whether you hold the cross between days, hold it on the rope or doesn't, right? There are all sorts of places in this thing that depends. Yes.
I would say, do you think of this example, this is a situation where we have potential Girsa issues that are influenced by Scrambler, or these are all ideological Girsa issues?
So far as I know, in the Rishonim, there is really no place where a Rishon consciously chooses a Girsa. They all interpret, as far as we can tell, they all interpret the text in front of them.
Okay, because the text, then do you think that the variations in the text in front of them that we have are the sorts of variations that, because you spoke about, variations where you have like a dollar train or a range or things like that, which...
All the variations we have here are perfectly normal scribal errors. Right, you reverse two positions in a focus, right, you switch Rava and Rava, you have a classic case where you have two statements of the exact same form, and you transfer one to the other.
I don't see any reason.
None of the textual terms we have in the Rishonim are anything out of the ordinary, and there's no place where anyone says Haki Gafinan. So it seems to me that the Rishonim, so far as I can tell, are interpreting the text that they're given. Interesting, that number of Rishonim seems to be explicitly aware of an alternative text. But we know, that certain theorists, like somebody says, well, that can't be shot because Rabbi Yossi is quoted to refer to Ape Plata. The solution to that is, no, it's not a contradiction, because Rabbi Yossi isn't quoted to say about Ape Plata. Right? That's an easy answer, right? So Girsa is one way of doing that. Okay, so we'll go on to the second one. Akimsa is also very easy one to understand. Akimsa says that the way to deal with a conflict between texts is to say that whereas we thought that at least one of them was referring to a whole class of cases, and so we thought that both of them were referring to a whole class of cases, actually at least one of them is dealing only with a narrower frame. Really, every Akimsa that resolves a serious, they refer to the double Akimsa, which is saying that this is talking about that case, and this is talking about every case about that case. Right, and that's a,
That we thought this text dealt with a broader set of cases than in fact it deals with. It's the same kind of case.
So one easy way of getting out of space, it says in one place, this kind of Lashon Hara is Mutter, and the other case says this kind of Lashon Hara is Mutter, we can say, well, the case where it says it's Mutter, that's because there were three people there. All right, that solves the problem very nicely. Now, it doesn't add any new information that we didn't know about, right? The law is exactly what we thought the law was before. It just finds a way for the text to conform to the categories we already have. And very often, as Kent is actually written in this text, and you start looking at the text more carefully, you discover that, in fact, the text does obviously tell you that you just didn't notice its significance before. Sakira is when you claim that two texts that use the same term, and therefore you thought they were talking about the same thing, are really talking about something about entirely different categories of things. If you thought the term Lishna Bisha is Mutter in front of three, and it says there Lishna Bisha is out there. Well, no. Really, one is talking about Lishna Bisha being Megalos Tod, and the other is talking about Lishna Bisha talking about Devar Shulginut. Right? And not because they're all part of the same category, because really, they're totally different things. Right? Using the Hebrew terms actually is complicated because it sounds like you're making an offense, but you're not. You're claiming that really there's two different things. There's a privacy issue, and there's one kind of prohibition which is a privacy issue, and another kind of prohibition which is an insult issue. And unfortunately, the Talmud is using them by using the same terms, but really they have no relationship to each other whatsoever. Okay, more often you use that when you have two texts that contradict each other by implication, and you resolve it by saying that, one. The implication of one another is not at all because we're dealing with the solution category. So it's actually curious when you make a conceptual distinction and argue that two things can contradict because there's no reason to believe that property X of category A should apply to category B. You wouldn't say that because Lashon Hara is Mutter in front of three, therefore murder is Mutter in front of three, right? Someone might have made that mistake because if they look, well, it says Lashon Hara, it says Lashon Hara is like Shifa Tami, and Lashon Hara is Lashon Hara 3, therefore Shifa Tami is going to be number 3. They know. Lashon Hara is a verbal category, and verbal things are changed by publicity, and Shifa Tami is a consequentialist category Lashon Hara is a virtue category, and the virtue changes the name from the 3 because you have guts, and this is not even a consequentialist category. The person's dead. The person doesn't stop being dead because you come in and come in and
dead. Right.
So also have most of our being consequentialist theory. I agree. That's a nice model where we claim, even though they're both called Shifa Tumim, but one of them is a virtue Shifa Tumim, and one of them is a consequentialist Shifa Tumim, and there's no contradiction because if you care about consequences, the person stays dead. No, we all know that. They come to life again. The film of the 3-year-old in a leap year. This is the classic case of also turning reality is also believe that the film of a woman regrows if my hand is broken less than 3 years old. So the interesting question is what happens if it breaks during the 37th month of her life, and the 37th month is retrospectively declared to be a leap year. Okay, so if you pay 3 years in the formal category, then what you can do is claim that the halakha determines reality that you go. So the Ra actually says it explicitly, the halakha determines reality, and a physical feature that would not have regrown will now regrow, or that hadn't regrown will regrow, I tend to have a certain amount of discomfort with this position and suspect that it wouldn't get out empirically if we were to some reason to try the experiment.
Is the law in general going to empirically? No, that's the whole thing.
So then, what happens
if
they... Well, it's a fairly safe step as opposed to checking whether we actually, when boiling steel pots actually get that little molecule of nitrogen.
I was wondering, boiling steel pots is legal.
Hedgebone
is when you say, you know, the later is all they protect, is to claim that they reflect different positions. Right, and so what it involves turning a stir into a muffler. Right, if you thought of your question, Brian? So the easiest, cheap way to come out is to say, well, Ross said one plus one equals two, but Ross said one plus one equals three. Oh, when Ross said one plus one equals two, it's talking for himself, but he said one plus one equals three, he was just quoting a certain thing and using the whole way. That's the cheapest form. But a much different form of Hedgebone, which is much more reasonable, is if you know that in the Gemara there's a machlokas between a Zayin Rava about whether saying something the fun of is kosher kinko the solution of Isha or not, let's take your position. And then somebody will supply hypothetically, says, oh look, here's a text other than the Gemara which holds kosher kinko the solution of Isha. Therefore, it can't be that Lashon Hara is better than Pano. And they say, no, the text you quoted is only the Abaye. Right, the Abaye. Right, we hold like Rava, go home. That's right. If you know there's a machlok of any position, then you can take any text, which is cited as evidence it must be true, and say, no, that just follows the rejected position. So when the Chavetz Chaim provides evidence, if you want it to be compelling, so you have to demonstrate that, at least try to demonstrate that that you accept the text is quoting as the correct text, and the contradiction is not resolvable by presuming a different text. You have to assume that the texts are actually talking about the same case. You have to assume that the texts are talking about the same concept, and you have to assume that the texts are being said by positions that you agree with. Because any one of the right, because you can get rid of this evidence in any one of those four ways. You can say, sorry, I don't accept that text. You can say, sorry, that text is not talking about this. Practically, sorry, that text is not talking about that conceptually. Sorry, I don't hold like the person who said that text. And those are tools you can use in any case, and they are ways which if you hold that a position is impossible, right, they make it very easy to get rid of all the opposing evidence. One of those four tactics will be possible. Now, you have to figure out whether they're, like Elkinta, of course, is easily usable. So Elkinta is a very common technique for judges and post-game. So you have a result that you want to reach. We have a text, which is against you. So what we do is you either claim that your case is somehow different than the text, or the text, right? This is a very narrow case and doesn't fit into the rule, or you say the text is a very narrow case and I'm talking about this. Right? So, for example, that text is talking about a closed society. Right? But we live in an open society. End discussion. And now we've put that text off into a sizable box and we no longer have to deal with it. Right? Now we can set up that text meaning without going to tell them it's talking about a closed society. And we're talking about open society, now we've gotten rid of the whole tomorrow. Very nicely. Right? Or, you know, the Chavetz Chaim is talking about the virtue of the individual, and we're talking about the good of society. So the Chavetz Chaim just became irrelevant on a secure basis. Right? He's talking about an entirely different phenomena. Okay, how is it? Yeah. Sound rather than host, yeah.
So, I guess we don't really know yet, but I guess the question we're asking is, what degree does the Chavetz Chaim actually use these four ways of dealing with conflict in the Sugya, or is he manipulating them in order to push his agenda?
Yeah, so I don't have to be, you know, the challenge of the whole program is that you should
recognize that there's never anything outside you other than your colleagues which forces you to do anything, because there are always ways to evade it.
Right.
And on the other hand, you have to act with integrity. I still look at his client and act with integrity, and he wasn't trying to manipulate the system. Right? He genuinely believed.
He's doing this very smart, but I'm saying, like, you don't really know how he uses these four ways of dealing with.
That's right. Well, I think more he does do them pretty good. What the client is going to, do largely is to quote a whole series of texts and say that you can't distinguish these texts, therefore you have to interpret all the texts you've already done in light of these texts.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, well, you know what? No, I have one of these four, but on one of these four axes, it seems to me that those texts are easily distinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even simple, yeah, well, the first page of the time quotes is the 53, which seems to say that the final record of the final is worse. And if we're going to say, oh, so that's up to right, so that's 53, well, goodbye. Right, and we're, again, my job is just to point out how much room you have, and your job is to figure out how you use that with integrity.
Mm-hmm.
One of which ways is by talking to colleagues, and seeing if colleagues refuse to believe that you mean this honestly, then that calls for a question on that session about whether you just meant that you get, or whether you're actually trying to figure out what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know that there was,
You have used all these body constrictions. How do you know if the solution is true, or the solution came after the fact instead of constriction?
How do you know, or how do you know, for yourself or for someone else?
For yourself, and I'm curious, meaning like the Gemara comes out and says, like, oh, this is according to the rabbi, and the second phrase, but, and then, but, like, it's not really, you know, not the contribution, it's like, I don't know, that's really true, and it's not actually, like, Rabbi's just really confused, and, like, has to put it in
a test. We all know the Gemara is true, it's not your job to know that the Gemara is true. And that sounds, you know, you want to do the best.
Well, then you have to come into it, believing that everything was just a true argument.
Oh, okay, I believe it's binding, but you have to believe that they were honest. And they tried their best, and you're not likely to do better when you have any evidence they didn't have. Right? They're more likely to have more, right? But you might think it doesn't matter if it's true or not, or you made a mistake of finding you because that's the only thing that works effectively. The thing with Gonzalo doesn't bother you very much, right? The biggest issue is for you. If you think this is the right result, and now you think of a way to get to that result, and you ask yourself, do I really believe that it's possible that this text is only reflecting a life vision, and the rabbi would have just said, oh, okay, that's one sheep of that she's all right, or do you really not believe that? And if you really don't believe that, then can you say it? If you're more figuring out for yourself, how you know about your own decisions. The Gemara, you can be charitable about this, and you're acting with the greatest integrity that they can. Okay, have you any questions? Okay, so Rav's the very objective.
All the examples that you've given of using these four methods of resolution all seem to be methods that go with Kula. I was wondering if you could potentially go get, use these methods on understanding Rav Barakuna, and then...
Sure. When Rav Barakuna said that things almost turn into three people, he was only talking about statements that are ambiguous. On Wednesdays in the spring of leap years. Right? And always right. So we can make a think of that what a perfect way, what a perfect
do. What is the standard for integrity here?
I think integrity is internal.
The check on standard integrity is whether you're open, genuinely open to other people's arguments. That's usually the standard of integrity, and whether you acknowledge evidence or you ignore evidence. Those are the usual standards.
Although,
without confidence, you care about that. So there are going to be, again, you're going to have Arminian points, right? Which will be much less susceptible to argumentation about. The starting point is that he really believes in his relative majority, that he really accepts the consensus of the community committed. All those are things like that. But other than that, I mean, again, try doing the program just to get used to have the experience, and then be really open with yourself and be open to college critiques and see if in the end you're convinced that you have a process of integrity, or at least you start the process. and hope they recognize that Judith folks can all have to struggle with this. That, you know, it's not a, if you're smart, so then it's always easy to get the result you want. You know, the challenge, right. And the problem is not to think of the alternative. The problem is how to, yeah. And not just how to admit yourself with it, but how to really be honest in that process. And yeah, some people see me crazy, some people don't. Okay, Debbie, you were next.
You gave an example that
the people who are talking about inclusive society, we're
talking about open society. Mm-hmm. How does it differ from the modern status of then, the system now, that we usually consider for Nancy O'Neill and Nancy Gullock? And outside the system, and Radical Liberal, and Kittle. I only said that yesterday. So, I'm just not kind of thought it's the inside the system, where it's said by somebody with a long gray beard and a black hat, and outside the system, where it's said by somebody wearing
boots. I'm just kind of not sure. Well, somebody who's neither, I guess not. What I would say is probably there are two kinds of issues that. One is, you believe that they would have done the same thing then. But when you say that was then, this is now, what it often means is that it was wrong all along, but I'll never be willing to go along with that. So I'll be willing to say, okay, but so the confession to you, I'm willing to say it was true then, but it's not true now. I don't really believe that. Whether you believe the person, he really says that was then, this is now. Then it's much more likely that it's still within the system. I just have a client, and he's better than that one in education.
Once you let
me
say it individually about 613 times,
it
no longer matters whether I'm
also
saying it about the
cat. In Akinami, if you can say it 613 times, you can get enough people to call you, then it would be true. That's right, that would be awesome. In Akinami. I think the way societies work is very rare. I mean, you still have to explain the text, but that was then, but the Torah still means something. The Torah wasn't, right? I'm not saying the Torah was then, this is now. Now, some people try to do that, and that's really dangerous, and that's, you know, that's like slavery, right? So that's the danger of the... Yeah, that was a slavery argument, right? That was a concession. Right now, we know better. In Epinomium, those are dangerous in Epinomium, but what is it? Pardon?
Like the wrong one's
dangerous in Epinomium, because it's about the one. I'm not willing to concede that he says it's Archivanus, which I'll be quite that way. But, you know, we'll look at the Romance that is about slavery. And lots of people say that Microsoft Tellar and things like that. And yeah, it's dangerous, you know, and I forget what Dumbledore said about truth.
Yeah.
I think that's the... Yeah, you know, if you want to maintain power, then it's much easier to deny that you can ever make that argument, but then you end up, the things you can't do, the best, you know, there are times you have to say that within this now, you know, in every world, right, you know. In one of the Jewish Conservative publishes a very nice piece by a wonderful human being saying that, you know what, even when, let's say, a deathbed says that it's still a fiat for rebellion to randomly hit this Talmudim in order to create a proper atmosphere in the classroom, and going back to Chosef Shevet saying, no, that was Anderson now. Right, everyone understands that Torah has to adapt to reality, and reality changes, and then you have to say that was Anderson now on some level. The check is always integrity. There's never any check. Texts can't defend themselves. Texts can't defend themselves against you. Legal system, law can't defend itself against the entire population. Depends on what? Do they think a lot is binding? Do we think of the judge with integrity? And by the way, is their judgment good? Right? Because... Yeah, repeated bad judgment is also a cruel solution. Okay, Jeffrey.
So going back a little ways. So you're talking about making a decision based on, you know, going back into some kind of example. The Sifri is like a body, you don't have like a body. Right, so you take it back, and you make it into a Mahomes 9 between the Sifri and whichever other surface are on that side. Probably the subject you saw for today, that I talked about today, Monday, and whatever we're going to talk about them. But so a bunch of those subjects all seem to talk about private being worse than public. And then, so it becomes a focus denying, and it's not, I mean, at least, and I have a very hard time once I get there, and looking through the figures in the Bobley, figuring out, this is especially, there's not a lot in the Bobley, and it's not clear, really, whether the Bobley box is one way or the other.
Yeah.
And there aren't really rules determining between a Bai and a Rabba who's right. Are there?
No.
How do you end up with this? You've got...
Yeah, if I enter out, let me say it's the three against Rabiosi. Yeah, the interlinguistic proof is that not Omar to Rabiosi, that must mean that Rabiosi was controversial.
Right. And it's not even clear that Rabiosi is really talking about this, but Rabba seems to think he is. I don't know what to do with that at a certain point, actually.
So probably, you know, standard methodology is that you Paskin like the murder of the opponent, but the Rishon of Paskin like. Right? We don't tend to often accept the extremists. Undo the consensus stock of the Rishonim.
Right, and so the Rishonim popped in like Rava for the most part. They popped in like Rava with all these crazy inferences that I for the most part don't buy.
Ah, so that's right.
Okay. So like, then you end up, you know...
That's a fun challenge. That's a fun challenge. I don't have a better...
You can talk about like Tosfos, I guess, but then...
Right.
And then, yeah.
Yeah, it's always fun.
Right.
Okay, other questions? I think we should finish. Okay.